Welcome to Recogs, the inventory success podcast where we discuss how the top operators source, manufacture, finance, and sell their inventory in order to create successful businesses. I'm your host, Mike Gelb. I'm the community manager here at Manufactured. Manufactured is the inventory success platform for consumer and B2B companies. Now, what do we mean by inventory success? Well, we help SMBs manufacture, finance, and distribute inventory and products across 20 categories. Looking to help reduce your COGS or looking for inventory financing or selling on new channels? We're happy to see if we can help at manufactured.com. Are you looking to reduce your COGS or inventory costs? Or are you looking for inventory financing or selling on new channels? We're happy to see if we can help at manufactured.com. So we're officially on our second season of Recogs. Or should I say our second year of Recogs. Now this content is free and hopefully it's been super helpful. But we do have one small ask, if we may. If you're getting value from the show, subscribe on whichever channel that you're listening on, whether that's YouTube, Spotify, Apple. If there's another third-party app that you're using, we would love it if you would subscribe so you can get every new episode, get a notification every time there's a new episode. We also throw events. We throw coffees. We throw happy hours. We throw dinners. We like to bring the SMB community together. And to learn more and to get involved, sign up at manufactured.com/events. That will also be located in the show notes. Kick off year two, our guest today is Al Sweet, who is the founder of Sweet Supply Chain Solutions, where he helps young brands optimize their business processes, streamline operations, and enhance supply chain planning. Previously, he was at Spanx for 16 years as their senior director of demand and inventory planning, and at Privé Revaux, the polarized eyewear brand. We discuss how he helped grow Spanx from a seven-figure business to a nine-figure revenue brand, how to think about what products to sell in different retailers, analyzing product assortment while he was at Privé Revaux, and how early-stage companies should approach inventory planning. Here's Al. Al, thank you so much for joining me here today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a great day here in Atlanta.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's actually great here. Great day here in LA. And I know that you probably think that every day is a good day in LA, but it's been raining the past like 2-3 weeks. So excited to have the sunshine out. How did you get started with Spanx? How did you meet Sarah? What was, and at what point of the business when you came into the business was Spanx at?
Yeah, so I was moving from New York to Atlanta, out looking for the next best opportunity in planning. And I found some folks over at the Spanx team. And they were, they were probably less than 10 people at that point in time. So, you know, super small. You know, people think of Spanx now as this big giant women's movement shapewear brand, but we were, you know, 10 people in an apartment. And so they thought they needed everything from operations to human resources, but I convinced them that really they needed planning. They needed to get organized and figure out, you know, where is this demand going to take them? So that's kind of where I started at Spanx. You know, it was 10 people, and 15 years later, we were hundreds of people and many, many, many dollars more.
Before you joined, how are they doing inventory planning up until that point?
kind of a back of the envelope. It was, they were basically kind of running from one thing to the next. But, you know, and now that I've worked in two startups, I kind of understand, you know, you've got to manage priorities on every day. So they were kind of back of the envelope saying, I need to place production or else I'm not going to have it for fall. So they would back of the envelope it. So that's kind of where I try to give them a little bit more structure and how to go about doing that.
When you came in, I guess the first thing when it comes to, you know, inventory planning, how do you actually inventory plan from like the beginning? In terms of like product selection, in terms of picking, you know, how much of each product you should actually buy, and then also maybe also like mapping out the different seasons for your products.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the whole process really in two stages. One is, I'll call it demand planning, sales planning, really, what is our customer going to buy from us? That's really the first thing. You can't buy something unless you know what you're going to sell. So that's really the very first piece of it. And so we would look at point of sale data. So not just what the customer is buying from us as a wholesaler, but what are they actually selling to their end consumer? It really gives us a good indicator on what's going to resonate. Because a buyer could buy too much or they could buy too little, but it's that consumer data, that consumer information that was really important. So we would start out by watching that consumer data. So whether it's our e-commerce site or even retailers providing us POS data is really super important. So starting on the front side of really watching that product sale and which products are selling, which ones are not. And then as we launch more customers, are we going to launch them in bestsellers? Are we going to sell them something custom? So all that front site demand is really important to understand and being as accurate as you can. And forecasts are never accurate, but you try to do the best you can. And then that really leads into the inventory side of things. So once you know your demand, obviously you know what you own, and you have to factor in lead time from your factories in terms of understanding how long is it going to take. So I can't own a month's worth of inventory if it's going to take me 4 months time to get product in. So you have to have enough inventory on hand to cover your lead time. So the whole process of buying inventory really is soup to nuts, from consumer demand to purchase demand to inventory placement.
And figuring out as well how much time it takes to create the number of products that you're looking to create, the amount.
Right. That's that lead time. And when I talk lead time, I'm talking not only time to get it from factory to warehouse, but also manufacturing time as well. And knowing that by particular category, different categories have different lead times. So you have to have different standards in terms of what you own.
How would you all assess when it came to retail accounts, when it actually made sense to actually enter into a new account or bring a new account into the fold?
Well, you had to kind of understand what kind of price points were they willing, was there a threshold for what kind of price points that they were willing and could sell? So in the example of Spanx, we actually had two different lines. We had an assets by Spanx line and then Spanx, because they had different price point tiers. So we would sell one at Target because there was a price sensitivity at Target versus what you would sell to Nordstrom or Dillard's or QVC or on the Spanx website. So you had to kind of understand that tiering.
How also did you all think too about as you were expanding, how did you also think about financing inventory too? Was that, did it make sense, for example, to use mostly cash in order for to actually finance the inventory? I know that there's, usually net 60 or net 90 terms. So working capital,
Well, that's a really important piece to call out, because not all new businesses have terms with their factories. So the sooner you can get terms, the better. Because if you're giving your customer 60 days to pay you, and your factory is not giving you any terms, then you can be out of cash pretty quick. But if you can get terms from your factory at similar rate that you're giving to your customers, then you're turning your cash over in time to pay for what you've purchased in inventory.
When you joined, did you already have terms with your factories, or were you all had to pay up front every time?
At Spanx, we had terms. At Privé, we did not have terms. We actually had to pay some of our factories before they would ship, or a portion of it. Some of them were not full pay, but there might be a percentage, like we need to have 30% down and then the rest when it ships. So, but that's something that, sometimes takes time. You got to build credibility with your factories and not treat them just as a vendor, but as a partner, so that you have some credibility that over time you can get terms with them.
When you do expand into a new account, for example, how do you think about product selection in terms of which products that you actually should sell in this new account? I'd imagine that you're probably looking primarily for your hero product or the product that you're known for, but I'm just curious to hear how you think about it.
It somewhat has to do with the lifestyle of the customer as well. So if you take you know, if you've got a line where you've got some, you know, you've got a customer who's a little bit more forward thinking, like say a Nordstrom versus a Neiman Marcus or a Saks, it's a little bit more traditional. You may have to skew some of this kind of the assortment to those different brands. Or in the case of my eyewear business at Privé, we had to take a look at it. Like if we're looking selling into a like a surf shop or one of the mall skateboarder shops, they're going to take something that's much more fashion oriented. Versus if I go into a department store, they want much more standard things like aviators and, you know, basic frames. So you have to kind of understand what the customer stands for as well. And then price point's important. At Spanx, we had two different lines. So you had a line that you could sell at Target because there's a price sensitivity there versus the main Spanx line that you would sell on Spanx website and some of the main department stores. So you have to think about kind of price point tier as well as kind of the branding around the retailer.
And what were differences between those two lines?
Similar types of products, just there wasn't as much make in the lower brand as there is in the main Spanx brand. So the construction was not the same.
Would love to talk to, I know that you brought up with Privé. What brought you to the opportunity to start at that company?
Yeah, so I was ready to get in, kind of in back into, I'd been doing some more business intelligence work at Spanx and was really looking to get more back into the operations and planning piece, and had a friend who was over at Privé Revaux, and he needed somebody with some planning background, also somebody who could come in and put some structure to their organization. Again, they were at that point, Privé was 5 or 6 employees and they didn't have any real systems in place. There's no way to measure anything. So it was kind of a great place to jump in.
Was it predominantly that business at the time? Was it predominantly like direct to consumer online, or was it predominantly wholesale?
No, it was both. It was both. I mean, it was when I came on board, we had private equity money that had just infused into the business. So it was big enough where they were starting to get some real, you know, doors at wholesale.
Would you say it was a priority more so to grow like more wholesale accounts or kind of more so like the direct to consumer business?
Both. Both. In the early, yeah, it was about volume. So we were looking to find, you know, which retailers would be willing to take on a, you know, a celebrity brand at a price point. And at that point, we were only a sunglass business. So we were looking for as much distribution as we could possibly get. And then, you know, a couple of years down, we ventured into other categories, which gave us even more breadth of distribution when we got into optical frames, aside from just sunglasses.
How do you think about the differences a little bit when it comes to demand planning, when it comes to e-commerce and e-commerce business, or the e-commerce sales channel or selection of sales channel, let's say just the D2C channel, versus, for example, wholesale retail businesses? Can you talk a little bit about some of the differences that you have to kind of account for when it comes to those two differences?
B2B businesses, a lot of times they're resetting their floor seasonally. I mean, we would reset and add newness seasonally on our websites as well, but where they reset at a B2B, there's a whole fill up the store kind of stage to the business where, you know, if you're going to put 5 new styles in, you've got to have enough inventory to fill all the stores. So from a inventory and demands standpoint, there's a big surge at the beginning of seasons to get those retailers up and running, where you don't have that surge necessarily in e-commerce because you're not filling the pipeline. You're just kind of turning it on to consumer demand. So there's always a huge set at the beginning for B2Bs. And then you're trying to figure out what is that replenishment rate going to be after that. So once you launch, they're similar in that, at least in our businesses, because we were offering a kind of a replenishment model where customers could get replenishment every month on anything, versus, you know, in some businesses they only fill up the stores twice a season and that's all they do. You know, they're ordering, but most of my business has always been replen businesses.
For the wholesale side, how did I know you talked a little bit about product selection in terms of what the actual customer that's coming into the store, what what those types of companies are customers are looking for. If it's a surf shop, for example, as you mentioned, it's has to be kind of trendy or in style, for example, that might then lead to a sale for sunglasses. But how also do you think about the number of SKUs to maybe start with when you actually get a new account? Like the certain number of styles, the certain number of SKUs that actually make sense when you actually launch in a new store?
Yeah, sometimes it depends on the retailer too, on how many they want, how much space they want to allocate to you. It may, for us, like in Privé, when we went into Kohl's, they wanted to have a dedicated branded fixture. So that was great because that was 100 units that you could put on a fixture. You could have a really broad assortment, and that was terrific. Versus, you know, like a surf shop or in the mall, they have cases of all kinds of brands. So they might only give you two or three SKUs. So then you have to try to think about, for their brand and their look and their consumer, which styles within our assortment do we think are going to do best? So you might only have a half a dozen styles that go up. So I guess the answer is it can range depending on the retailer and what investment they want to put into a brand new brand.
How also do you think about the relationship between, you know, the brand and the manufacturer? In terms of like the communication, like how often do you actually, would you actually be communicating with your manufacturer and actually being, have them being actually involved in that process when it came to inventory planning?
Oh, I mean, we were talking to factories, depending on what was going on. It could be every day or at a minimum every 2 weeks, because we always wanted to make sure we knew status of our orders. Was everything on time? Was there any delays? Were you have any problems getting? Because we just needed to make sure that we were hitting our dates. In terms of quantity, they really weren't, at least in my experience, they weren't involved in the plan of how much. They were looking for more from information from us on how much demand do you think you're going to have in the next 6 months. So they're trying to plan space, you know, factory space.
Totally. Totally. That makes sense. How did you as well made sure when you produce the products, how did you also think about quality control and making sure that the products were exactly what you ordered, to your specifications, and that they're actually produced the actual way that you wanted them to be?
Yeah, I mean, every product, and this is particularly, I have a lot of involvement at Privé, was having quality like a standard. Like we had a documented standard on what needed to be in every frame, and along with the individual specs from each frame. So, and then we used a third-party inspection service in China so that, though we were here before any PO would leave China, we would have those orders inspected for quality. And if they failed, we would charge the factory back for those units not meeting the requirements.
That makes sense. And obviously, like totally, especially having like a third party that actually does the inspections, obviously not the manufacturer, but actually have someone else to do those to make sure that it's quality.
Yeah, I do think though there's something to tracking it as well. So making sure that you're getting good reporting on those inspections so that you can over time figure out what your strengths and weaknesses are within your factories. So that's something that we wanted to, you know, make sure that we had.
How long should you give a new channel, let's say like it's a new account on the wholesale side, on the retail side, how long should you give that store, or maybe it's a few stores in a region, how long do you give it to actually see if this is working? And that it can become, not now, but in the future, like a profitable, a successful channel for you?
I mean, we try to watch it from day one. I mean, that's, as I was saying, kind of at the beginning, we want to watch those POS sales right off the bat. Because if it's not checking, we need to go in and make sure we understand why. Is there something wrong with the fixture? Did the product not make it to the selling floor? We want to be proactive about making sure that demand is, there's not anything impacting that demand.
So it's not like, hey, let's give this, let's see how the sales do within the first like 6-9 months, for example, or is there like a certain period where.
I don't know that we're necessarily putting a timeline on the channel. I think the customer, our customer's probably putting more of a timeline on it, like whether we're a viable brand and are we creating enough sales, enough turn on that inventory to warrant staying. But I've never really been in any kind of an environment where, you know, you're only in for a few months and then you're out. Like once you're in, you're usually in for quite some time.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that, you know, is there like an assessment period of, hey, we're going to assess this new account for the next 9 months, see how sales are. And then if it didn't go, for example, according to plan, the turns aren't there, the velocities aren't there, then we're going to pull out because we don't think we can be profitable in that channel. If there was some type of period for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only place where we've really, in both businesses, is watching is where the additional costs of running that business might be a deterrent to being in the retailer. You know, if the retailer is chargeback happy, you know, if they are doing chargebacks for every little thing, that gets expensive. Do you have to give them a lot of samples? Is that expensive? Do they want free returns? Is that expensive? So it's discounts, it's returns. So sometimes it's the back end costs that will sometimes deter us from staying with a channel for a long time. And that sometimes takes, like you say, it could be 6-9, it might be over a year before you really start to see some of these things that you really weren't aware that you could get hit for.
That's interesting that it's more so that the actual retailer or the buyer might deter you in terms of staying in and staying out based off of some of the charges that you might incur.
Yeah. I mean, we had a TV network brand, TV network type business that just was very expensive to participate in. So you either have to get a lot of volume to offset all those other costs.
So I know that now you're advising quite a few startups that are kind of that do have some demand, you know, maybe around like 20 million or less than 20 million in that kind of range, kind of early on in their journey. What do you see some of the problems that they're running into when it comes to demand planning, inventory planning, and I even just thinking about inventory overall? Because I know that when you obviously start a company, you're so focused on demand. You're so focused on, hey, do we actually have something here that actually can sell, that people want to buy? And then once you do, then it might be like an oh crap moment. Okay, what do we do now to actually be able to service that demand? So how do you think about maybe, or what's your pros to maybe advising these companies when it comes to the operations and inventory side of building businesses?
Well, the first thing I try to do is make sure that they have good visibility about what's really selling in their business. A lot of times they're running so fast that they may not have magnitude on how big a category is of their total or how small a category is. So they're going off a lot of gut intuition versus trying to put real numbers behind it. So that's really what I try to bring in is to give them some clarity on what's really happening. So that's more from a demand side, so that they know which categories they should be investing in more and which ones they're probably over investing in. Sometimes it's also helping them figure out what inventory they own that is not productive right now. Like they just got a bunch of stuff. They need to figure out which ones should be reorderable and which ones to get out of. So there's oftentimes a kind of a SKU rationalization, which things should we keep, which ones are selling well, which ones are not, and which ones we should liquidate. And then trying to get them on a cadence, a reorder cadence. Sometimes they're not always great about thinking about that, like, should we do a forecast every month to see what's selling, what we've got left? So getting them kind of organized and structured.
How do you think about product assortment and number of SKUs? I know that you mentioned that, you know, some companies, they might have so many SKUs that they don't even know what's kind of selling, what's not, what's like the hero product and what's not the hero product, just because they're kind of moving too fast. But why does it make sense for a company, for a smaller company, to actually branch out and actually have more SKUs versus, you know, a company that actually maybe should have it more streamlined and really focus on, you know, a small selection of products?
Well, sometimes when you're small, you have to start testing a few things. I think the key is to maybe understand what is rate of sale on some of your items that you have now, and do you think you can sell in similar volumes? A lot of times, you know, Privé has some smaller businesses, and I like to also say, can you sell your production items? So if I know that my factories require us to buy a certain amount, do I think I could even sell that amount before I would consider adding it? So, and then a lot of times there's a little bit of push-pull. The marketing person may want something that's, you know, super high fashion because they want to put it out on social media and do all that kind of stuff with it. And that's fine. You have to do that. It puts a good brand forward, but you have to figure out in your mix how much of that fashion forward stuff you're going to have versus the meat and potatoes that are going to drive sales day in and day out. But typically I like to think of, can I sell my inventory? Can I sell, if I have to make, you know, 1,000 pieces of something, how long is it going to take me to sell 1,000 pieces? If I think it's going to take me 2 years, then that's probably a style I'm not going to add.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I've heard another of different, and obviously this is also fairly category dependent. You know, if you're a fashion brand, then you probably are going to be having to launch, you know, a lot of kind of new styles and also think about, you know, seasons and different, or an apparel brand, you might have to think about seasons. So you might have a lot of different SKUs. Obviously you have sizes too, as well thrown in there. Whereas, you know, if you're a cosmetic company, maybe you don't have nearly as many SKUs, and it's more maybe streamlined in terms of the number of SKUs, and you're maybe a bit more selective when it comes to what actually what products you want to launch and where to actually take your brand.
Yeah, I think part of it too is thinking about it up front on what do I think my sales plan is going to be for the season or the year, just so that you can put some boundaries around that style count. So that, you know, if you know that, you know, I do $1,000 a season in an average style, and I'm going to do $10,000 of the season, I can only have 10 styles. So, I mean, having some thought around how much you think you're going to do. A lot of times that's when you start to get into real planning and preseason planning too, where you're thinking about how much your sales goals are.
When you do find entrepreneurs or companies that actually do have excess inventory, it's inventory that they can't sell, how do you think about maybe some creative ways in order to liquidate, in order to actually sell that excess inventory?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether, if they have the ability to sell B2B businesses, there's a lot of, you know, off-price marketplaces that you can sell, retailers that sell off-price, you know, your TJX's of the world. If you're an online business only, I have one client who does a lot of warehouse sales. So they promote that, and they have local people that come into the warehouse and buy some product. If you get really desperate and you can't sell it to any, you know, main brand B2B off-pricers, there's always, you know, liquidators offshore that will give you pennies on the dollar if you need to get out of it. Sometimes so you can do bundling sales on your website, special events.
One founder that came on this podcast, what I thought was also quite unique, was for some food and beverage packaged products, there was a broker that sold products heavily discounted to the Amish. I thought was really interesting because, of course, the Amish don't really care about brands, right? They really just, as long as it's a product that hasn't, that obviously hasn't expired and that it's good, then that's, you know, a sales channel for, you know, a food and beverage brand if you do need to liquidate. So I thought that was kind of like an interesting niche business too for the broker to be part of. So first of all, we have a couple closing questions. First of all, what would you prefer to be? Would you prefer to be sold out or do you prefer to have excess inventory if you're a brand?
Sold out.
Second question is, what would you value more? $100 of inventory, $100 of COGS, or $100 cash?
Because I have more places I can spend it. I can spend it on COGS or I can spend it on marketing. I can spend it in different ways.
I like to think about it as, I mean, my perspective COGS, because if you have margin, if there's demand for your product, then you can turn that COGS into, then you can turn that inventory to cash, and that $100 COGS is worth more than the $100 cash. Again, you probably need to probably market it a little bit, but
I guess I was just thinking of when you sell your COGS and you've got that cash, then you can reinvest it. So that's why I was thinking cash.
Al, thanks so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
Yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. A lot of times, you know, Privé has some smaller businesses, and I like to also say, can you sell your production? So if I know that my factories require us to buy a certain amount, do I think I could even sell that amount before I would consider adding it? So, and then a lot of times there's a little bit of push-pull. The marketing person may want something that's, you know, super high fashion because they want to put it out on social media and do all that kind of stuff with it. And that's fine. You have to do that. It puts a good brand forward, but you have to figure out in your mix how much of that fashion forward stuff you're going to have versus the meat and potatoes that are going to drive sales day in and day out. But typically I like to think of, can I sell my inventory? Can I sell, if I have to make, you know, 1,000 pieces of something, how long is it going to take me to sell 1,000 pieces? If I think it's going to take me 2 years, then that's probably a style I'm not going to add.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I've heard another of different, and obviously this is also fairly category dependent. You know, if you're a fashion brand, then you probably are going to be having to, launch, you know, a lot of kind of new styles and and also think about, you know, seasons and different, or an apparel brand, you might have to think about seasons. So you might have a lot of different SKUs. Obviously you have sizes too, as well thrown in there. Whereas, you know, if you're a cosmetic company, maybe you don't have nearly as many SKUs, and it's more maybe streamlined in terms of the number of SKUs, and you're maybe a bit more selective when it comes to what products you want to launch and where to actually take your brand.
Yeah, I think part of it too is thinking about it up front on what do I think my sales plan is going to be for the season or the year, just so that you can put some boundaries around that style count. So that, you know, if you know that, you know, I do $1,000 a season in an average style, and I'm going to do $10,000 of the season, I can only have 10 styles. So, I mean, having some thought around how much you think you're going to do. A lot of times that's when you start to get into real planning and preseason planning too, where you're thinking about how much your sales goals are.
When you do find entrepreneurs or companies that actually do have excess inventory, it's inventory that they can't sell, how do you think about maybe some creative ways in order to liquidate, in order to actually sell that excess inventory?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether, if they have the ability to sell B2B businesses, there's a lot of, you know, off-price marketplaces that you can sell, retailers that sell off-price, you know, your TJX's of the world. If you're an online business only, I have one client who does a lot of warehouse sales. So they promote that, and they have local people that come into the warehouse and buy some product. I mean, if you get really desperate and you can't sell it to any, you know, name brand B2B off-pricers, there's always, you know, liquidators offshore that will give you pennies on the dollar if you need to get out of it. Sometimes so you can do bundling sales on your website, special events.
One thing that came on this podcast, what I thought was also quite unique, was for some food and beverage packaged products, there was a broker that sold products heavily discounted to the Amish. I thought it was really interesting because, of course, the Amish don't really care about brands, right? They really just, as long as it's a product that hasn't, that obviously hasn't expired and that it's good, then that's, you know, a sales channel for, you know, a food and beverage brand if you do need to liquidate. So I thought that was kind of like an interesting niche business too for the broker to be part of. So first of all, we have a couple closing questions. First of all, what would you prefer to be? Would you prefer to be sold out, or do you prefer to have excess inventory if you're a brand?
Sold out.
Second question is, what would you value more? $100 of inventory, $100 of COGS, or $100 cash?
Because I have more places I can spend it. I can spend it on COGS, or I can spend it on marketing. I can spend it in different ways.
I like to think about it as, I mean, my perspective, COGS, because if you have margin, if there's demand for your product, then you can turn that COGS into, then you can turn that inventory to cash, and that $100 COGS is worth more than the $100 cash. Again, you probably need to probably market it a little bit, but
yeah, I guess I was just thinking of when you sell your COGS and you've got that cash, then you can reinvest it. So that's why I was thinking cash.
Al, thanks so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
Yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Planning and preseason planning too, where you're thinking about how much your sales goals are.
When you do find entrepreneurs or companies that actually do have excess inventory, it's inventory that they can't sell. How do you think about maybe some creative ways in order to liquidate, in order to actually sell that excess inventory?
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether, if they have the ability to sell B2B businesses, there's a lot of, you know, off-price marketplaces that you can sell, retailers that sell off-price, you know, your TJX's of the world. If you're an online business only, I have one client who does a lot of warehouse sales. So they promote that, and they have local people that come into the warehouse and buy some product. I mean, if you get really desperate and you can't sell it to any, you know, name brand B2B off-pricers, there's always, you know, liquidators offshore that will give you pennies on the dollar if you need to get out of it. Sometimes so you can do bundling sales on your website, special events.
One thing that came on this podcast, what I thought was also quite unique, was for some food and beverage packaged products, there was a broker that sold products heavily discounted to the Amish. I thought it was really interesting because, of course, the Amish don't really care about brands, right? They really just, as long as it's a product that hasn't, that obviously hasn't expired and that it's good, then that's, you know, a sales channel for, you know, a food and beverage brand if you do need to liquidate. So I thought that was kind of like an interesting niche business too for the broker to be part of. So first of all, we have a couple closing questions. First of all, what would you prefer to be? Would you prefer to be sold out, or do you prefer to have excess inventory if you're a brand?
Sold out.
Second question is, what would you value more? $100 of inventory, $100 of COGS, or $100 cash?
Because I have more places I can spend it. I can spend it on COGS, or I can spend it on marketing. I can spend it in different ways.
I like to think about it as, I mean, my perspective, COGS, because if you have margin, if there's demand for your product, then you can turn that COGS into, then you can turn that inventory to cash, and that $100 COGS is worth more than the $100 cash. Again, you probably need to probably market it a little bit, but
yeah, I guess I was just thinking of when you sell your COGS and you've got that cash, then you can reinvest it. So that's why I was thinking cash.
Al, thanks so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
Yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
And there you have it. Al, thanks again for coming on the podcast. If you like this episode, please subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. If that's YouTube, Spotify, Apple. We would also like to have you get involved in our events. You can sign up at manufactured.com/events. You'll be the first to know about all the events that we're planning. And finally, if you're a brand owner that's looking for inventory financing, manufacturing, or distribution help, we're here. We're Manufactured. Come visit at manufactured.com. Next week, we'll be having on Mike Fata, who is the founder of Manitoba Harvest, the Canadian hemp company, which he sold for over $400 million. We talk about his approach to operations from when he was just starting out to when they were at scale. Stay tuned.